Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @RightStream and hashtag #RightStream. Thanks for listening to the Right Stream Radio Network.
Good day, and I hope you are well. This is John Gresham in Fairfax, Virginia, and we're here for Military Monday. Now, this begins a week of remembering our veterans, and it's worth noting that not all veterans necessarily go and wore a uniform when they did their service. There is, within the United States government, a small, elite, and very, very little-known group of people who have worked within the clandestine services of our intelligence community to go and to do those missions which either can't be admitted, can't be acknowledged, and in many cases are just incredibly necessary. We have today a rare, rare gentleman, a man who lived a career as a CIA field operations agent, who also was a member of our military, is an author, and now working towards veterans' causes. His name is Gary Burnson, and we are very fortunate to have him today. Let's see if we can get him on here. Are you there, sir?
Pleasure to be with you today.
Gary, it's really, really a pleasure. And just to make it very clear to our listeners, this is not something that people in your business do very often. In fact, many of those I've known who've worked in your particular profession tend to shy away from people like me in the media. Talk a little bit about what is it that you did once upon a time that made it necessary to live this different life.
Well, I'm a retired member of CIA's clandestine service, and so members of the clandestine service, or the Directorate of Operations at CIA, travel abroad, and they do two things. They're involved in FI, foreign intelligence collection, and CA, covert action. And the CIA doesn't sort of acknowledge, you know, who their people are abroad or that are doing these activities, but I spent a full career of almost 24 years in CIA. Prior to that, it was 4 years in the military, but my CIA time was all as a member of CIA's clandestine service, pursuing the interests of the U.S. government.
Now, you just said you started in the military. Talk a little bit about your career as it started in the military, and how were you recruited? How did you become a spy, for lack of a better term?
Well, I had sort of an unusual military background. You know, I enlisted in the United States Air Force at 18 years old in New York, actually, you know, enlisted in that recruitment booth there at Times Square, for anybody who's been to Times Square.
Really?
Went in the Air Force and was a crash firefighter, which has absolutely nothing to do with espionage, but it was a great job to have, where we worked and supported, you know, the aircraft, and aircraft, when if they were to crash and have problems, we would be the people to pull the pilots out, put the fire out, save the ejection. Safety of the ejection seats, new barrier operations, you know, to catch them, you know, in snowy places like Galena, Alaska. And I served in Korea, Osan, Korea, Galena, Alaska, and then Kirtland Air Force Base, New Mexico. I knew at that time that I wanted to continue my service to the country. So the first thing I did is the day I got, while I was in the Air Force, I got 2 years of college done at night. And the day I got out of the Air Force, I signed into the Marine Corps. And then I would spend the next 2 summers going through officers' candidate training program, in a program called the PLC program, the platoon leader course in the Marines, with the objective of becoming an infantry officer. Prior to my graduation from college and commissioning in the Marine Corps, I would meet a CIA recruiter on a campus who would convince me to apply to the CIA also, was tested, was evaluated, and was offered a position in the Central Intelligence Agency in their clandestine service. It was 1982. And I decided to go with the CIA instead of taking the commission in the Marine Corps, and then would spend the next several decades serving in the Middle East and in hotspots around the world on behalf of the clandestine service. CIA, people need to understand, works for the presidency. We work for, we're under the executive element of government, executive branch, and we provide intelligence for the president and for key staff so that they can help make, you know, those decisions that are in the in you know, that will get the greatest benefit for the United States. I stated earlier, we do covert action, and that's achieving some results for the U.S. in economics or politics or war that are, when we say covert action, that are not openly acknowledged by the U.S.
Out of curiosity, the recruiter that came to you at college, what kind of an opening line do you use on a young college student to say, hey, how would you like to join the CIA?
Well, I wasn't your sort of average college student because even though I was in the Marine Corps PLT program, I was getting a minor in Russian studies. It was the Cold War. I was a Cold War kid, and I was also a skydiver, you know, so I was involved in sport parachuting. And one of my professors knew the recruiter and said, that's a young man that you should probably talk to because I think he would make a good case officer. You know, we, you know, when you say someone who's an operations person in CIA, we don't call them agents. The sources that steal information for us are agents. CIA officers are case officers. And I was, you know, selected to be a case officer and would serve in that capacity as a case officer first, and then later as a chief of station, the senior person that the CIA has in a particular country that is the director of CIA's representative in that country running all operations. And I would do that on multiple occasions, you know, later in my career as I became more senior.
Okay, so you were recruited. You made the decision to pass on the Marine Corps. You go into this business. What kind of training that you can talk about did you do to prepare yourself for this case officer?
2 years of training. It is 2 years of training at a minimum before someone goes into the field, and then if you add language on, that can be 3 or 4 years. And you know, CIA is serious about providing that their case officers with the training that allows them to run assets, human sources successfully, and to conduct paramilitary operations. So, you know, you'll go through training on recruit sources, wound sources. You went through a paramilitary course that, you know, had me, you know, jumping out of airplanes again, you know, conducting, you know, learning how to run small units, it's like a special forces course. It was back then, at least. It was a longer paramilitary course when I went through training back in the early 80s. And it, you know, what we're looking for when we recruit people is a high level of motivation, people that have the ability to learn foreign languages, and you know, people that have a, you know, just a very high level of commitment to the country and serving its needs.
Looking back after 25 years in the service, do you feel like that course was really relevant and useful to you as you moved along in your career?
In a lot of ways, it was, and I probably made more use out of some of the things that I used in the paramilitary portion of the course than others would, because later in my career, I would be on the ground in Afghanistan leading, you know, paramilitary forces in eastern Afghanistan and would be the person that would be on hand when we would seize Kabul, and I'm the guy that ran the Tora Bora operation, which destroyed a large component of bin Laden. So the skills I got there were useful. I met great people in the CIA. I have to tell you, CIA is the single greatest place in America to work, in my opinion. It had a highly skilled workforce, motivated people. There were some really great leaders there. You know, there's always problems in any organization with bureaucracy, but by and large, it was, for me, it was a dream come true, and it was an experience like no other.
I guess this may be a sort of an inane question, but it sounds like you had fun, didn't you?
I had quite a bit of fun. I never felt like I had a job. I was living a mission, and the mission that I had was, you know, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And the domestic ones were the ones I was working against because CIA works abroad. And it was, again, I had the privilege of serving abroad, serving in many American embassies, working close with the people in the Department of State and many ambassadors, and I have the utmost regard for my State Department colleagues and the ambassadors that I worked for. They shared the same risks that we had, that we endured in a lot of these posts where there was hardship, the same dangers, and you know, many of them really distinguished themselves and did wonderful things for America.
This is Military Monday, and our guest today is Gary Burnson, a former CIA field case officer and a rather intriguing gentleman, as you've probably already figured out. And if you'd like to call in, ask a question, or give a comment, please call us in our call-in line, 347-945-7246. Again, that number is 347-945-7246. Gary, your career obviously extended over a fairly significant period of time, but the work you're best known for is for your time in Afghanistan. Let's talk a little about that. When did you first become involved with Afghanistan?
Well, you know, later in my career, of course, beginning in the early 80s, I would become involved in, I would study Persian, I would become a Farsi linguist, and work on things Iranian for years. So I had the language, which was useful in Afghanistan. You know, Dari is what they speak in Afghanistan, many people, and Farsi in Iran are essentially the same language. But I would be working on Hezbollah operations, would be the chief of Hezbollah operations in CIA in the late 1990s. And, of course, our embassies were blown up in East Africa on the 7th of August, 1998. I would be dispatched to lead an incident response team out there to support the U.S. government in those cities in East Africa after having the embassies blown up and had so many people killed. And when we got out there, and I was led the deployment because we believed it was possibly a Hezbollah attack. And, of course, once I got on the ground out there, we captured a number of Sunni terrorists who immediately admitted their involvement with Osama bin Laden. I had heard about about bin Laden before. I knew about our efforts against bin Laden and al-Qaeda prior to that time. But my first, you know, operational activity against them took place during that incident and working with the FBI and the Department of State in rounding up and capturing the bombers. Most recently, of course, Anas al-Libi was captured in Libya, and he was one of those individuals that escaped the dragnet that we threw down and, of course, captured all these years later. And so that was my first taste of it there. And then, of course, about a year and a half later, I would be asked to participate in a team that entered and was on the ground in Afghanistan when the Taliban were in control of the entire country. We would teams of small numbers of Americans in there to work with the Northern Alliance to try to keep them on life support, and met with and worked with the people of Ahmad Shah Massoud, the famous Afghan warlord and the head of the Northern Alliance, and so was on the ground with him and his folks in 2000. And then, of course, once 9/11 occurred, the attacks of 11 September 9/11, I was then selected to lead the big team. You know, CIA would have 6-8-man teams put on the ground, but I would lead the team that was on the Shamali Plains just north of Kabul and would be given the task of seizing the capital and managing the operations in all of eastern Afghanistan.
When you were waking up like the rest of us on 9/11 and realizing what had happened, did you have an immediate sense that you knew who had done it and that you were going to be involved at that point?
Yes, on both accounts. When I saw I was, of course, in Latin America at that point, serving as a chief of station, and watched the second plane go into the second tower, and I knew, of course, that it was I could sense right away that it was an al-Qaeda operation, and I assumed that we would be going to war in Afghanistan, and I assumed immediately that I would have a position in that conflict.
Just as a matter of curiosity, real quick, you talk about having worked with Massoud, who was the head of the Northern Alliance up until his assassination the day before the 9/11 attacks. What were your impressions of him, and how would history have been different if he had been available to us, not only during the war itself, but maybe even today as a national leader? Would he have been one of those defined people?
Well, Massoud, of course, played an important role in Afghanistan, in that, you know, those opposition elements that someone to rally around. Massoud was a guy that was not just cooperating with the U.S. He was working with the Iranians. He was working with the Russians. He was working with the PACs. I mean, he worked with everybody, and he took funding from everybody. You know, so he was sort of a complex figure. In many ways, we were disappointed in our dealings with General Fahim, who was his successor. But my own opinion is, had Massoud been alive, it may have been more difficult to move forward because Massoud would have wanted to be the leader of Afghanistan, and as a Tajik, that would have been a problem. We needed a Pashtun. We needed Hamid Karzai. People are unhappy with Karzai right now, but you have to understand that Karzai was a man at that point that had no blood on his hands. All the other the commanders that we worked with had essentially participated in activities that would give them the title of war criminal under almost any circumstances. Karzai was the only guy we could work with. He was the one the Pakistanis wanted to work with. The Iranians saw him as suitable. The group in Rome with the king of Afghanistan, the former king, they found him acceptable. So Karzai was the perfect guy at that point to make provisional president. And had Massoud been alive, this may have been a more complicated thing to do. General Fahim knew he could not be the national leader and was willing to be the Minister of Defense and essentially become the vice president ultimately because he understood that the makeup, the demographics and tribal makeup of the country wouldn't have supported a Tajik as the first leader. We needed a Pashtun.
Now, you wound up going in and heading up the CIA's efforts in eastern Afghanistan as head of something called the Jawbreaker Team, correct?
Correct.
This meant that you were working extremely closely with various members of the U.S. Special Operations community, particularly the Army Green Berets, the Night Stalkers of the 160th, the Rangers from the 75th. Talk a little bit about your partnership with those people and what did they bring to the fight and how did that partnership work out in your mind?
Well, you know, when we arrived there, Central Intelligence Agency and Army Special Forces had never run any joint training programs involving, our case officers like myself and Army Special Forces. We had never done even training. We'd never even met one another. I was fortunate in that I would meet both John Mulholland, who was the commander of 5th Group, a very fine man, who's now the deputy commander of SOCOM, and, of course, the lieutenant colonel, the most senior guy on the ground for him in the country was a lieutenant colonel by the name of Chris Haas, who is now a 2-star general, a major general, and he is the commander of all special forces. Chris Haas and I would establish a very strong relationship from the moment we met. We were both born and raised in Long Island, probably 20 miles from one another. The CIA brought intelligence, knowledge of the ground, linguistic experience, and special forces brought logistics and firepower. You couldn't tell the difference between CIA officers and special forces officers. We were all in civilian clothes, mingled in with each other, working with each other seamlessly. My regard for the men in special forces is very, very high. They were very, very brave. They went forward right onto the front lines using, special forces laser control, laser designators to paint targets, and it kept a very large number of the enemy off of us. On the Shamali Plains, there were 15,000 Taliban, and we were lucky if we had 6,000 with the Northern Alliance defending. They had three times our numbers. And we put the special forces forward on the front lines with those lasers, and were able to target the enemy and keep them back and keep them off of us as we were able to identify more and more targets deeper behind their front lines to destroy their logistics and then essentially destroy their front lines. So, it was a close relationship and one of great admiration on my part.
You're talking about two gentlemen I'm very close to and I'm proud to call as friends. And I will just say, having spent my share of time around the people who were in those early A-teams that arrived into the country, particularly Triple Nickel up on Bagram and 595 up working with General Dostum, they still think that the greatest thing in the world when they stepped off the back end of their helicopters into the darkness was that the first person they saw was a CIA case officer with a handout saying hello.
Yeah, well, we had great relationships with those. The Triple Nickel did some very, very hefty lifting there. And, of course, that 595 up there with Dost Tom, really, Dost Tom was probably the most effective fighting commander that we worked with. You know, he's running for vice president now. He'll be on a ticket with former head of the IMF World Bank out there in Afghan, who's running, and Dost Tom's actually, you know, back in the political mix, which is hard to believe, but he is.
Yeah, considering Dost Tom never had a reputation as a friendly gentleman.
No, not at all.
Although the guys from 595 loved him like a father, and what can I say?
They loved him because, you know, he would fight. He would fight, but the fact of the matter is it's always sort of problematic when you're dealing with him because when the fight's over, he's still fighting.
Yes, as I said, he does not have a warm, cuddly reputation for good reason. Now, after you finished up your work with Afghanistan, you retired. And what have you been doing since then?
When I finished my work in Afghanistan in 2001, I went right back to Latin America and did several tours as a chief of station in Latin America working on counter-narcotics and other regional stability issues. So I continued for a couple of more years there. Then in 2005, I retired. I wrote the book Jawbreaker, which was
a
New York Times
listeners, by the way.
And then I wrote a novel called The War Policy Book called Human Intelligence, Counterterrorism, and National Leadership. Then I ran for then I would go to Afghanistan for another year. I worked as an advisor to the 173rd Airborne Brigade Combat Team and was positioned with a group called Task Force Paladin working on IEDs and IED networks out in RC East, Regional Command East. Did that for a year. And then, of course, I would run for the U.S. Senate in New York. I was the Republican nominee against Schumer and was defeated in the primary when those on the left and other parties, like the conservative parties, all worked together against me to block me. I did get 45% of the vote in New York on the first run as a nominee, but it wasn't enough. Since then, I've been back to Afghanistan, worked on contracts, done a number of different things, and I'm living in Florida now. I live in the Tampa area. And continue to do contracts in the Middle East, and have been working for the last year and a half for a group called Concerned Veterans for America, which is a 501c4, and we're for small government, lower taxes, and fiscal responsibility. It's an important group with an important message because, truthfully, economic security is national security. We are in such terrible danger with the size of the debt and if we don't address these things soon, we will not have the financial wherewithal to play the role in the world that we need to play to ensure a stable and prosperous world for us and our allies.
Let's talk a little bit about that view of the world and ourselves that you were just talking about. You've obviously been in the military. You've been in the intelligence community. As you sit here today talking to us, what do you see that concerns you about our military, and where do you see us being in 2017 when a new president arrives and has to deal with the consequences of the actions that we're doing today?
Well, we're heading into a period of significant drawdown. The U.S. Army is going to be reducing itself from 45 brigade combat teams down to 33. It is going to reduce the number of aircraft carriers. The number of air wings are being reduced. There are serious, serious reductions across the board. Now, we recognize that because of the economics of this, some of this is necessary. And a drawdown, in the face of having withdrawn combat forces, large numbers of them from both Iraq and Afghanistan may have been in order. But the problem is that the failed management of our budget in Washington, D.C., by both political parties, presents a greater danger to the U.S. than any foreign adversary. When you look at the fact that we have $17 trillion in debt, that our deficits have been more than $1 trillion a year for the last four years, and of course, you get the spin out of Washington as they said, oh, the deficits are going down. Oh, it's only $700 billion this year. And that doesn't include all the money that they're printing. quantitative easing 3, which is going on now, is $85 billion a month. Listeners should recognize that's $1 trillion a year in money that they're not borrowing. They're just simply printing it, which is undervaluing our currency, which is going to essentially cause a devaluation of the currency. The economic dynamics that we are facing, the downside of this, is going to affect our ability to feel the force for the 21st century, to pay the force, to take care of our people. And, we're going to have to recognize that, you cannot do massive economic redistribution in a society, and while you're doing that, believe that you can field an effective force to play the roles that the United States wants to play in the world.
Now, let's switch gears a little bit. You just talked about the open side of it, the U.S. military. But the U.S. military won't even know where to go and what to do and who the enemy is without an effective and robust intelligence community to tell it what to do and who the enemy is and what they have. Talk a little bit about the current state of the intelligence community, and before we go to break, give us your view of where it's going and where it will be in 2017.
Well, I think most people need to recognize, they probably know this, but they just don't hear it verbalized, is that what you are seeing right now with the release of all this intelligence as a result of Edward Snowden's theft of intelligence and weekly releases of damaging information, is undermining the U.S. Intelligence and national security apparatus. It has been week after week that we have had revelations of collection in the U.S., revelation of collection on key U.S. allies and regional partners in the Western Hemisphere, and this is the death of a thousand cuts. When the president made the statement that he wasn't going to scramble a squadron of fighters just to deal with a single, hacker, he could not have been more wrong. He completely misread the danger that has been presented. And we're going to have to think long and hard about how we re-engineer what we've been doing and to reestablish faith with the American people and our closest allies in the world, because, some of NSA's collection of force is very, very important and does a great job. But, some of the collection they may have been doing may have just been foolhardy, and they just sort of went overboard, especially when I'm talking about if it is proved that they were, in fact, collecting information on the Pope, that would just be utterly ridiculous.
Interesting. In terms of the intelligence infrastructure as it sits here today, what parts are you satisfied with that we're going to preserve, and where are your areas of concern for the near term?
Well, I think, I'm sort of a traditionalist. I don't believe that you should have a director of CIA or director of national intelligence that sits on the cabinet. Intelligence officers provide information. They do not provide policy guidance. They should provide the facts as they exist. And the problem is when you have someone on a cabinet, just like Bill Casey was on the cabinet for Reagan back in the 80s, and you've got a cabinet, you've got the DNI as cabinet members now, there's too much room for problems. I'm a traditionalist. I think that we need to go back to the model where you have the DCI as the single most person that leads the community. I don't think we need a DNI, the Director of National Intelligence. This structure has not worked. It has bloated the bureaucracy with another level of bureaucracy, and so I would do away with the DNI's office as quickly as possible, and at the very least downsize it by 75%. I mean, this thing was started off as supposed to be a staff of about 300 people, and I got several thousand people over there now. It's just ridiculous. I think that we need to focus on the fact that that we need an enhanced human capacity, because there was an over-reliance on technical collection, and a lot of that now is drying up because of these Snowden revelations and the exposure of methods and techniques. So we're going to have to get back to basics. We're going to have to continue to field a large human force, and we're going to have to support that force and recognize that they will do a lot of great things, and every once in a while they're going to have problems too.
Gary, we want to talk to you a bit more about your work with Concerned Vets and your views on veterans as well, but let's take a quick break and have a couple of promo messages. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
You're listening to the Right Stream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. RightStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, tune in to RightStream Radio Network for Just Believe with author and metaphysician Lisa Tarvez. Lisa interviews experts in the areas of health and wellness, alternative healing, paranormal phenomena, intuitive guidance, and positive living. With her own inimitable down-to-earth style, Lisa makes both guests and callers welcome and appreciated. Just Believe with Lisa Tarvis, Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock Eastern, 6 Central, here on the RightStream Radio Network.
And we are back. Gary, you still with me, sir?
Yes, I am.
Let's talk a little bit about that other veterans group I mentioned at the very beginning. People like yourself who've worked for the clandestine service. You guys don't get to go to the VA, do you? Unless, of course, you had prior military service, correct?
Right. I had prior military service, so if I had a problem, I could go to the VA. We are a civilian service, but many of our officers are veterans. On the paramilitary side, a disproportionate number are veterans, almost all of them, because you wouldn't have picked up those skills anywhere else. My role with Concerned Veterans for America started about a year and a half ago. I had been involved in veterans issues, understood the importance of them, and I, in addition to being a veteran myself, I have a son who was with the 82nd Airborne, did two tours in Afghanistan. He's a captain, and I have a daughter who is a veteran who was a U.S. Naval intelligence officer, and now she's an American diplomat on her way back out for a second assignment. So all of us. In my family have served in one way or another. There's a tradition of service in my family, and so veterans' issues are near and dear to our hearts.
Do you feel like those individuals within the clandestine service who don't have prior military service should be extended veterans' benefits, perchance? In other words, should they have a special status that allows them to access VA and that sort
of... They have pretty good insurance. They have an excellent private insurance policy. So I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't ask for that. If they're injured in combat operations, they've got NCIA, and CIA has their own casualty officers that deal with the deaths of officers. And it's a small service in compared to the military. The military has some really great challenges because of its sheer size. But the CIA officers have excellent insurance and a strong support network when casualties do occur, and so I wouldn't worry about or propose putting them inside the VA. I wouldn't do that.
And you talk about the fact that this is a small service, and obviously the exact numbers are highly classified and not worthy of discussion.
Right.
But when you were talking about the DNI's office with thousands of people, by comparison, at any given time in the clandestine services, my understanding is we're talking a few hundred men and women in the clandestine service.
A bit more than that, but the point is that there's probably more people in the DNI's office as staff people than we have in the field worldwide. I mean, it's we, you know, the problem is that even after 9/11, a lot of politicians and talking heads ran around Washington saying, you know, we need to connect the dots. Well, we don't need to connect the dots. We need to collect the dots. The theory of collection, if you have excellent collection, connecting them won't be hard. And so, you know, you have a lot of people that all want to be in the intelligence community or want to be in CIA, and, you know, they want to sit in Northern Virginia and, you know, write reports and, you know, and be involved in briefing the president or others. But the most critical work takes place abroad in violent, nasty, dirty places around the world. Excuse me. And you need people to go out and collect. That's the hard business. You don't get to watch your kids play soccer in Virginia, you know, in the north, you know, in Northern Virginia in these leagues. Or in Maryland, you know, you got to go out into the world, you got to sacrifice years and years of your life to develop that craft and then put that craft to work for America.
Very true. Let's talk about your work with Concerned Vets. Talk a little more about the organization and what is it you actually do.
Concerned Veterans for America is an organization that's for small government, lower taxes, and fiscal responsibility. We're trying to get veterans involved in the political process. We don't support any particular campaign, but we support small government, lower taxes, and fiscal responsibility. We recognize that the country is being bankrupted by big spenders from both political parties, and they are not recognizing the long-term consequences of their deeds. You know, when you are both borrowing $1 trillion a year and printing $1 trillion a year, you will undermine the underpinning of the greatest economy in the history of mankind, that of the American economy. And, you know, it will ultimately turn into, you know, large-scale unemployment. We won't have the growth in the country we should have. We won't be able to provide for a defense that we need to provide for. We won't be able to field the force that if we bankrupt ourselves. And this country is on the road to ruin economically. It is not being managed properly. You look at something like Obamacare, you know, the fact is Congress passed a 2,200-page bill that no one read. The ultimate in irresponsibility. They did not read it. They did not understand the consequences of what they were doing. They just knew they wanted to do something, and they knew they wanted to redistribute resources to allow for more people to be covered under medical care. Well, you know, there would have been other ways to create maybe a $5 billion pool for people with pre-existing conditions. There would have been less expensive, less cumbersome ways to organize ourselves to take care of those that truly need help and to ensure that those that want to work are given a chance to work. But we've got a lot of people in the country, unfortunately, that are stealing resources like Social Security disability insurance. We went from 3 million to 12 million in a very short period of time. And, you know, it's like we quadrupled the number of people, you know, on disability insurance because they couldn't find work, and they essentially jumped from unemployment to SSDI. These are things that we cannot do if we want to continue to have an economy that's functional and manageable, and also that can sustain itself.
Very true. And in terms of yourself, what is it you want to do next? I mean, you're obviously working with this group. You've made a Senate run. What other things do you want to do with your life between now and when you decide to take it a little easier?
Well, I want to help build the force right now. I want to build a force of tens of thousands in this country and a million, if we can, veterans that recognize that elected officials need to be held to account, that we need to defend the American dream. We need to defend what our forefathers gave us. Make sure that we can pass that on to our children. I have children that are veterans. I have grandchildren. I want those grandchildren to have the same opportunities that I had and that my children have had. And only if this generation fights to ensure that, you know, that the dream goes on, you know, we'll be able to pass this along.
Gary, I want to thank you for coming on and talking to us today and giving us an opportunity to listen to your story and some of your thoughts on various parts of our government and our country. I know you have another commitment that you have to be at in a few minutes, so let us just say I hope we get a chance to have you on the show again sometime. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your family service, sir.
Very welcome, and I ask everybody to go to Concerned Veterans for America, concernedveteransforamerica.org, spell it out. Visit our website, see the things that we're doing, get involved.
Have a great afternoon, sir, and I hope it's as pretty down there as I remember Tampa being.
It is. Thank you, and God bless.
Thank you. And that, folks, is the end of our talk with Gary Burnson. We're now coming to the end of Military Monday for this week, but I will tell you we're going to be having a busy show next week. We will actually have the show on Veterans Day on Monday, and we're going to try and split it between not only talking about veterans with a former executive at the Department of Veterans Affairs, but we're also going to be remembering the fact that the day before, November 10th, will be the birthday of our beloved United States Marine Corps. So please join us and come next Sunday. Think about a Marine. Say thank you to him. And buy him a beer or give him an iced tea or something, because Lord knows, for them, Semper Fidelis means a lot more than you might think. For Military Monday, this is John Gresham, and thank you so much for being with us.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV and a man with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man, and now I'm out in the cold. What's the song? step, wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep, longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep, who gives his life to take. A flare through a pawn shop, a flare through a pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dear.